Thank you, Martin. I'm Ken and I'm an addict.
Hiya.
Thanks for your share, Lauren. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone. It's good to be here. I haven't been here for a while. I remember when the meeting started, a few years ago now, and I used to enjoy coming here and supporting this particular meeting. He was in, I think he was in the same block, but in a different part of the building. Upstairs, Rob's pointing. I remember those days, and I'm glad it's still here. And I did hear through the grapevine that maybe it was struggling for a while, but it doesn't look like it anymore. So whoever is responsible for hanging on in there, you know, keeping it going, throwing the money in the pot, well done. And I'm grateful. Thank you. So is that enough for the niceties? I'm very conscious of a very girly plaster I've got on my finger here. Look, it's the only one I could find. Pink with a heart on it. And the story is, I went to an F&E event in Birmingham, not the big one in Birmingham on New Year's Eve, but a few days earlier, we had a little F&E event there. All my kids turned up to say hello, and my kids' kids, and even my kids' kids' kids now are coming along. So we sort of took over the whole of this one of the rooms, and we exchanged gifts and stuff, but one of my daughters managed to slice the top of my finger there. And when I told one of my other daughters the other day, she said, "Dad, that makes two of her parents that she stabbed now altogether." I didn't know that she'd had a go at her mother all those years ago. Anyway, and also I had a guitar pedal for Christmas. I'll get on to my message in a bit. I had a guitar pedal for Christmas, and it was fantastic, a wah pedal, and I was giving it the big un all Christmas Day. And now I can't touch it because I took the plaster off. Yeah, I couldn't wait. Took the plaster off yesterday. Opened up the wound again. So back on with the girly plaster. I'll leave it for a couple of days now. I've been clean for years. And I am so grateful. I'm also a little conscious that I feel sometimes if I'm actually comfortable in my own madness, if you know what I mean. And sometimes I think, you know, I've been 25 years without using any drugs. No wonder I'm a little bit touched, you know. On the whole, I've enjoyed the journey. It's been so good for me, recovery, and for the people around me. I got clean through H&I. I was in a detox. I went to my first meeting on or about the 22nd of July, 1994. And I haven't used since. So I'm one of the lucky ones. I haven't had to engage with the relapses and all that goes with it. So I'm grateful for that as well. I sort of had my arm up my back to get me into the detox in the first place. It was a reluctant entry, if you like, into recovery. And halfway through the detox, I think it was a combination of my mental health was poor anyway by then. Physical condition was bad, bloodborne viruses, all that went with all that sort of stuff, that chaotic addiction. But my mental health wasn't brilliant, and I ended up lapsing into a psychotic episode while I was in there. And so when I went into that first meeting, I'm not too sure that I knew exactly. I was sort of, a fellow asked me if I wanted to go, and I do remember going, "Do I have to?" And the fellow who's a nurse said, "No, you don't. But I think you should." I've never had the opportunity to go back to him. I don't know what happened to him and say thanks for that day, because I don't remember much about the times that we engaged, but I do remember that, him not telling me that I had to go, but he thought that I should. And so I went there to do him a favour, really. Oh, nice bloke. I'll go and do that bit of people pleasing. And I went along to my first meeting. And, you know, wasn't particularly well behaved and didn't really engage with anything other than a little bit of envy and jealousy for the people who were there clean, in their clean clothes and their 40-pound haircuts and the trainers and the leather jackets and the clean, sheen, glowing, you know. I didn't like that much. And so the envy was... I was running on envy through the whole of that meeting. So much so that when it came to my turn to speak, invited to, maybe you'd like to say a few things, all I managed to do was have a pop, especially at the fella, you know, for having the temerity to turn up at the detox and have all the girls looking at him. And, you know, coming down here with your 2 years clean and your new clothes, all the birds looking at you. Cheek. He's still clean, the fella, I'm not surprised. And I share that with him often. He was the first recovering addict I ever met. And it's nice to know that he's still around. And I went back into my room after the meeting, the first meeting, and after helping myself to the literature, because they said, help yourself to the literature. It's free. Fine. And I do remember this. Another thing about the stories, we're going back 25 years now, and I know, because I do it myself, you know, he never said that last time, he said this, blah, blah, blah. I know how it goes. I'm speaking from memory. I haven't got anything recorded or written down. I've got no photographic evidence. It's just me riffing. So I definitely didn't look at the literature. I know that. That's a consistent part of my story. Anyway, and I threw it in the bin. And I was very despondent and depressed. And I remember lying on the bed and staring at the ceiling and thinking, oh, fuck, what am I going to do? I think I've burnt all my bridges. I don't want to be here anymore. I've got nowhere to go. I've got nowhere to live. I don't know where my kids are. You know, I'm missing my drugs. I'm mad. I'm angry. And I didn't have any hope. So I was lucky to come out of there clean. I was lucky to stay the course, and I was lucky to come out there clean. At the time, all those years ago, we were very lucky because you had a little bit of help. And if you needed to stay on, if you had nowhere to go, if you really had nowhere to go, you could stay on at the hospital. They moved you onto a little side place where you could stay and you get a little bit of help with housing. And I can even remember getting my teeth looked at the time, and all that sort of stuff was going on in those places then. I know it's not cheap, but I had the opportunity to at least hang on for a little bit until I walked out of that detox, a few weeks clean, with a key to some temporary accommodation, Peckham Park Road. I had a friend who just walked out, not walked out, who'd left the detox, also with a key a couple of weeks earlier, at the other end of Peckham Park Road. So we were able to buddy up, and I had made the decision that I'm going to go to NA. I'm going to give it a go. I don't know why. I up to now, I haven't heard anything or any reason why I wanted to come to meetings. I couldn't think of any reason why I would want to stay clean. I don't know why I didn't end up using, other than just maybe there was just enough willingness just to give this a go. I'm just going to have a little try, just one little go at seeing how things go for me. And lo and behold, after about 6 months, I'm so fucking miserable. You know, it's just done it. I'm done. And it's on Christmas Day. And I know that Christmas Day now in South London is a huge event. Everybody turns up. Everybody looks after everybody. It's great. But when I, on my first Christmas clean, there were about 12 of us in a church somewhere over in Blackfriars. And we're all really miserable. You know, we're the lost and the lonely. You know, no one wants us. You know, no one. We're just with each other. It was awful. I remember lying on the stage in this church thing, and at the time we were listening. There's no music or anything. You know, somebody had a little transistor or something, and we're listening to Capital Gold or something equivalent, and then. I'm a sentimental sort of bloke anyway, you know, country music is one of my things. So, and then on the radio comes the Green, Green Grass of Home, Tom Jones, and I start crying on the stage, and I'm really fucking miserable and really upset. And then my recovery buddy, female, who, you know, the truth is... there must have been a little bit of sexual tension there. So she, at the end of this little do, she came up to me and said, oh, because we go to meetings together, come together, eat together, do everything together, smoke each other's fags, blah, 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 blah. As far as I was concerned, she was mine. And so... she, at the end of the night, she came up to me and said, right, you see that bloke over there? And I said, yeah. She said, well, he's going to give me a lift home. And I thought, fuck, what about me? And she said, see you later. That was it. I was just so angry and even more miserable than before. No, we all laugh about it now because it's funny, but... really, that was it for me. I had to walk home from Blackfriars to Peckham, and with every step I took, I was more and more fucking angry. You know what I mean? Right. And that's it. I'm done with NA. You're not coming home. I'm not coming to any more meetings. Fucked a lot of you. That will show you. So I stopped coming to meetings for a while, and it did show me. You know, that within weeks, I'm in an area of Peckham that I was quite familiar with anyway. I spent the last 10 years of my using in and around that area. Within weeks, I stopped coming to meetings. I'm letting people into the kitchen to use drugs. You know, I'm in and around it all the time, sort of hooking up with what's going on. While that's going on, I've got people from NA who I've had enough of are knocking my door and then leaving notes through my door. Ken, hope you're okay. Ring this number. None of us had mobile phones, by the way, then. I didn't have one, I know that. Ring this number and we'll come and pick you up and take you to me. It's really loving stuff, you know. And seriously... hiding, like I'm hiding from the bailiffs or something, hiding behind the chair in my little temporary accommodation in case they saw me when they're knocking the door, asking me if I'm okay. And I just couldn't bring myself round to saying, I'm not okay, you know, I think it might be a good idea if I do come to a meeting with you. Thanks for thinking of me and thanks for dropping round. None of that was going on with me, and I very nearly picked up. I don't know. I can't remember. I know it was a Friday night, and the most important NA meeting I've ever been to in my life. I remember this. was South Norwood, the library, Friday night, and my foaming at the mouth. The sponsors here. That's why I'm telling the truth. South Norwood Library, Friday night. There were six of us in that meeting. And I surrendered on that night. I can remember opening my mouth and saying, I don't know what I'm doing. I need to be picked up today. I don't want to do that. I'd paid enough attention in NA. I had listened hard enough just to know exactly what was happening to people like me when we picked up. I knew that much, and I didn't want to go there. And I think that I surrendered on that day. And I can remember I was boundaryless as well. And, you know, I did like an audience once I got going. I must have shared for about half an hour, you know. There was only six of us there anyway. But I remember a fella after the meeting coming up and talking to me and giving me some really, really loving and warm and sensible practical advice for me. I haven't seen him since, that chap, because that's what happens sometimes, isn't it? You know, but I am so grateful for that. I was ready to listen, I think. He wouldn't have been the first person who tried with me, but he was the first person that I heard, and I was ready for that. So thanks to the people who tried before, but I remember he was the one who got through to me. I started my journey, you know. I got myself a sponsor and started chipping away at the steps, and things began to change, not just because of that, but I'm pretty sure that it was one of the reasons. He gave me a little bit of meaning and structure and things to do, and he helped me to look at me and trying to take responsibility for what I'd done and what I hadn't done that caused me to end up in the situation that I had. I would say after about 18 months, I was, loath as I was to admit it, I was actually enjoying my life and my recovery, and things were working out well for me. And the external stuff, which I never ever take for granted, and I don't think there's like, oh, it's this important, no, it's not as important as this is, but it is important for me, you know, to have things like, because I'd never had a driving license. I'd never had a passport. I still didn't have one. That had to come a little later. But that those sorts of external things, you know, all that sort of stuff began to slot into my life. And I began to enjoy my recovery. And I was taking part, living my life the NA way. Enjoyed doing my service, and ended up down at the detox that I'd been in, taking H&I, and things were going really well for me. Two of my three children were back in my life. My three girls, a lot of you know, they all ended up in care and institutions as a direct result of my addiction. It was a long way back for us. The two eldest daughters had just come out the care system as I got clean. So we seemed to hook up quite quickly. There was 120 miles between us, but that didn't stop us from being able to make the effort. Having a few quid in my pocket and bank accounts helped by then, being able to make the effort to communicate, hook up, start to rebuild our lives. And I've often said it, you know, I do know, I'm under no illusions, my children were very damaged by what I did and what I hadn't done, more importantly. You know, I think that they were victims of neglect more than abuse, really. So it was what they didn't have and what they went without that was really, that was something that I could put right. I became really quite enthusiastic about that and started taking that sort of responsibility, not overcompensating, but it became something that I could see that I could do, that I could get that put right, and I could let my children know that they've got their dad in their life if that's what they wanted, and I could provide, and I could give them a little bit of love, I'm as enthusiastic today about that as I was when we first reunited. My youngest daughter took a while because she was still in the care system. A little bit more of a story to this one. She, I went through all the proper channels. I had some encouragement with my sponsor and let's do this properly. Contact the social services. When she was first approached, I would guess she would have been about 9, and I hadn't seen her since she was 18 months old, and she said that she didn't want to see me, and I was not devastated, but I felt that I was broken. I felt that, you know, that just for those, for a while, what's the point? You know, this isn't supposed to be fucking happening. Everything's supposed to be, you know, that stuff got me down for a little bit, and there were people in my life who were really reassuring, you know. When we can't remember the practicalities and the realities of life, that just because someone says no today doesn't mean to say that they're not going to say no next week, tomorrow, next year. The Walt Disney part of the story is she turned up on my doorstep when she's nearly 16 years old. And we wouldn't have recognised each other if we'd have crossed each other's paths in the street. And she wanted to, she had nowhere to live. She just left the care system and she wanted to come and live with me. So she did. And 12 years later, she was still there. About 10 years too long, I think. We decided. In fact, it was me who had to move out in the end. I got married and moved out and left my daughter. I want to come back to that because I want to talk about a little bit about hope, because there's more to my daughter. There's a story. It's not a story, but there's something going on in our lives that I would like to share with you. So it's been really good, and I've been. That's the one thing that I just think. If I fell under a bus tomorrow, people would be able to say, you know what? He tried to do the right thing with his kids. He didn't. He came up short on many occasions, seriously short, but he didn't stop trying, and he tried. And I'm quite confident that people can say it, and I'm so proud of that, because I feel like I still feel going to places like, how could you? You know what I mean? You left them. You neglected them. You couldn't be fucking bothered. You know, it's still there. I can still go into that dark corner if I want to. You know, look at you. You know what I mean? You couldn't even be bothered. Look at you, you smackhead. All that sort of stuff can still resonate with me if I let it. There's a big success story. I've done well with my employment. I'm nearly at the end of my working life. Good, because I'm tired, I know I'm only 37. I knew as soon as I'm going to have to talk about it now. As soon as I went, I've been trying hard. A lot of you know my youngest daughter's ill. She's not well. She got cancer and. It sort of dropped in our lap a couple of months ago, and everything's gone really quickly, and boom, boom, bang, this is what we're going to have to do, this is how we're going to treat it, this is I found myself in worst case scenario. I couldn't get out of it for a few days, and I had to pull myself together and try and get focused, and nobody else is in worst case scenario. The people who we're talking to, the doctors, the nurses, the oncologists, the surgeons, all that, they're all talking curative. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to treat it. So we're there, three appointments a week. The one thing I'm trying to make sure that happens is my daughter isn't in the hospital on her own. So two or three appointments a week. My wife is helping. Her fella is a lovely bloke, George. So it isn't happening. She knows that we're there with her. And the treatment's rattling along. It's going that quickly. And you walk out of hospital. This is Western Europe for you. A, it can be treated. And B, there's carrier bags. And I mean carrier bags full of medication you walk out the hospital with. Injections for this, tablets for this, here's the bandages, here's the dressing, here's this and that, here's the number you deal with that, this is what you've got to do if you do that, this is what you've got to do, you've got to come here on this day, you've got to come here on this day, you've got to go there on that day. It's like, it's a thing, but it's, there is the answer, there is the solution, we have a solution here. And for that, I just think, I don't know, just by pure, you know, we didn't choose here. I'm just wondering what a 35-year-old woman in Guatemala is going to happen to her when she wakes up in the morning and gets diagnosed with that. I don't know, but I know what happens in Western Europe. You know, we can treat it and we can get it done. Anyway, I just go. Hopefully, I can get this out of my head. I'm sorry, but we had a little setback yesterday. Everything's gone so well. You know, this gone. Oh, look at this. We might not need to do this now. We get to the hospital yesterday and there's a setback. Look, this has happened. We're going to have to give you some more treatment for this. And it's really disabled my daughter. I don't know. I ain't got no answers. Fuck knows. I don't know. I don't know what we're going to... But the doctors are still... This has happened. This is what we're doing. We've got to do... They're really quite matter of fact. I believe them. I'm every confidence in these people. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. This is going to... But when we came out of hospital, you could see... She's going, oh, fuck. You know. This has got absolutely nothing to do with my journey of recovery other than this is what's running around my head right now, and once it's in there, I find it difficult to park it up. But I'm going to try, you know. And she's such a lovely girl, you know. Really, my wife and me, I've got three. Lorna's got two, five adult daughters, and I'm telling you, she is the one who's internally equipped to deal with this. She's got what it takes. I know it. So does my wife. And I think she knows it too. So let's just leave it there. I wanted to talk about a little bit of hope. Look, the book, you know, the step working guide. I don't have that much of an emotional attachment to it as some people. It wasn't there when I got clean. But I know some people, it's good to see, you know, they swear by it. This is, you know, how could you possibly have got a week clean without this book? You know, I don't know. But that's how it is with some of us, isn't it? We were just bluffing before, I think. But what I do know is only if you have a look at the book and have a look. I wanted to talk a little bit about hope, and I had a little look at step two in the guide there, you see. And the very first question in the step working guide is, what have you got hope? I'm paraphrasing. What things have you got hope for today? And I was able to think, I'm going to have a think about that. I'm going to have a proper think about that, because I know that I've got hope in my life today. If there's nothing else that I've got, I know I've got some hope. I know that without hope, life is really grim. And I can remember what it was like without hope. And I've got some. And I can hope that everything's going to be okay. You know, she's going to get herself better. She's going to recover. And things are going to be okay with her. I've got hope that I do... I don't know why I would call her my wife. A lot of you know, Lorna and myself, we've not had enough of you, but we want to move. You know, we have had enough of you, haven't we? We want to move. I don't want to grow old. Although I'm only 37, I don't want to grow old. I've had enough. We want to leave London, and we've got an opportunity to leave. We lost Lorna's dad earlier in the year, and there's a little bit of money there. I was lucky enough to be able to get myself on the mortgage ladder while I'm working, and got a little bit of equity in the property, and we're trying to organise some finances so that we can get out of town. The first thing you do, if you're like me, when you're looking to move, is how many meetings are there in that place? You know, and I was just talking to Martin, my new neighbour. How many meetings are there in that place? Let's go and have a look. And so we're hoping that next year that we get the opportunity to settle down somewhere else while we've still got a little bit of energy to integrate into a different community. So we're really looking forward to that. I don't think there's anything else that I want to say, really, other than I have got hope today, and I know that it's there. It's difficult to define, but I do know what it's like when you haven't got any. Now, what to say to those of us who haven't got any right now? Hang on in there. Keep turning up. It's going to get better. We've got some practical advice. We've got some practical suggestions for you. We can help you. You're not on your own. This isn't the end. It's not the end. It might not even be the beginning of the end. It might not even be the end of the beginning. But with hope, there is always, and this is one of my friend over there. He doesn't sledgehammer into people, but there is always a solution. There's always an answer. Hang on in there. Keep turning up. Keep coming back clean if you can. And thanks for listening. Thank you. Thank you.